Welcome to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Rolling Stone executive editor Nathan Brackett. Today we're going to talk about what happens when great artists make terrible songs. Even the greats do sometimes. We're also going to talk about new music from Wilco. But first...
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
And that was a little bit of If Ever I Was a Child from Wilco. Wilco just released two new songs. I'm here to talk about them with John Dolan, Record Reviews editor. Hey, John.
Hey, Nathan.
So this one's beautiful. This is like the prettiest, like most straightforward Wilco song I've heard in a while.
It is. It's a, you know, like you just heard, a pretty kind of folk pop song, you know, the kind of very stately but sweet and detailed playing that's not showy. It's, they're really in kind of a nice, you know, just mellow, confident kind of Wilco-y mood that they've been in, you know, recently. It's not, it's kind of a no big whoop kind of thing for them. The new record is called Wilco Schmilco, which kind of puts a real fine point on this.
You see these bands like who are at the stage in Wilco's career where they're kind of like flailing against this age we're in or their age where it's like, how do we get attention? Like, I you know, you see that in bands like, you know, maybe U2 or bands that try to, you know, have their Beyonce moment every time they come out. Wilco does not have that problem.
Well, they've never tried to be too big.
Right.
You know, they've always kept it at a very safe and kind of familiar level. I mean, and they have kind of, you know, they went through their struggles and tensions going back to the controversy surrounding Yankee Foxtrot Hotel, sort of band problems they had and some of Jeff Tweedy's personal problems. But the last, say, even now we're getting into like the last almost decade has been, from really since Sky Blue Sky, I think, which was 2007, has been just, you know, them making good, listenable, you know,
or sometimes records. Or sometimes great. It's not like they don't care. I mean, I think the title's a joke, but it's like they're very happy to just play to their fans.
Who that's right. Yeah. I mean, the
look like them.
Yeah, no, it's totally true. Look like us. Let's be honest. Look like us. Let's not try to, you know,
dad rock fans.
Come on.
Right.
We're sitting here. You know, like the last one was called Star Wars. I mean, that just seems to sort of say, like, look, it's a universal happiness. They released these two songs on the anniversary of that record coming out, the 1 year anniversary. One of the songs is called Locator. Even when the wheels are winding, something in the sky
can find me.
Sort of noisy, but also, you know, familiar and enjoyable kind of Wilco tune in this, like you say, this If Ever I Was a Child. It's funny, it's a classic kind of, the lyrics do kind of hint darker moods or sort of ambivalence in Jeff Tweedy's style, but he makes it seem like a pretty...
Sorry to cut you off. Locator for sure, like, has that Wilco mix of, like, you, like, beautiful playing and hooks that go into a darker place and then come back.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, like their last, I think that what made Star Wars kind of interesting is that they've always done different things. They've been a rootsy band, they've been a noisy band, they've been a singer-songwritery band, they've been a band that kind of recalls classic rock AM, you know, kind of radio, and they kind of were doing all those things sometimes in the same song. This seems a little more separate. You know, you have one song which is the pretty folk tune, one song which is kind of the noisy, more dissonant song, and it'll be interesting to see if this record kind of how they approach their different sounds on this record. Each time it's a sort of a new attitude within a kind of familiar scope.
You've also been listening to a couple songs from a younger band you like, The Paranoid Style.
Yeah, not that much younger. I guess like pushing about 40, but it's a married couple. They live in D.C. The singer is named Elizabeth Nelson. The guitar player is Timothy Bracey. And the way I would sort of, I guess not market isn't the right word, but the way I would describe them is they are probably the rock critic-iest band in the history. I mean, to give you an example, like they're named after a book, which is they're named after the Paranoid Style in American Politics by Richard Hofstadter, which is kind of a classic of – actually a timely classic. It describes kind of right-wing paranoia in American history.
Wow. Now more than ever.
Now more than ever. You got to go get it. It's on Amazon for a penny. And then on the cover of this record, she's she's sitting on a railroad track reading a novel by Raymond Chandler. She's reading The Long Goodbye. Yeah. So they're a rock critic. They have been rock critics. They've written about Yola Tango and other bands like that. But what makes this record great is
just such a comfortable place talking about this band.
I know it's
right
like
now.
You know, yeah. I don't mean to like scare everybody away, but they actually rock, which is helpful.
And
she's
terrific. Her voice is terrific.
Great singer.
This
really
real
funny,
Debbie Harry kind of conversational phrasing.
Totally. Yeah. They often sound like The Attractions or Blondie or maybe The New Pornographers, and the songs rock. They're fun and kind of rollicking and the lyrics are funny.
Which of the two? What are the a couple songs that you've been digging?
This one song, "The Thrill Is Back," is really catchy. I think there's one of the lines is something like, "If there's one thing I can't stand, it's a good sense of humor." It's all these kind of like cutting relationship or kind of cutting sort of jokes, not jokey but funny lyrics, dry, real dry,
more of a relationship song than a B.B. King reference, maybe a light.
The Thrill Is Back with an exclamation point. The exclamation point, I think, is deeply ironic. But the whole record is kind of full of all these hooks that keep coming out, and her dry wit. It makes it a really fun listen all the way through.
All right. And their new album is called Rolling Disclosure, and it's out now on all the major services.
It is.
John Dolan, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
When I was a little bitty boy, my grandmother bought me a cute little toy. Silver bells hanging on a string, she told me it was my ding-a-ling-a-ling, oh my ding-a-ling.
And that was Chuck Berry's My Ding-a-ling, his 1972 hit, which is going to kick off a segment I'm excited about terrible songs by great artists. I'm going to start with a disclaimer. The way that you get on this list is because you are a great artist. We're going to trash a lot of songs here, but all of these artists are people who are near and dear to our heart. The definitive list is on RollingStone.com right now. It was edited by Chris Weingarten, who's here.
Hello.
What's up, Chris? And I also have Andy Green.
Hi.
Hey. Today we're going to talk about our personal picks for the most terrible songs by our most beloved artists. And we're also going to talk about some of the picks that might have made it on the list or people were talking about when we put this list together. Let's start with this Chuck Berry song, which was, after all, his biggest hit ever, My Ding-a-Ling.
It was a true number one hit for a guy that basically invented rock and roll. It took almost 20 years. It was his first number one hit and his last. And for a guy that wrote Johnny B. Goode and all these masterpieces, it's sort of this weird irony that
the only
hit was this.
You can say cruel irony.
Yeah, an extremely cruel irony, but he was thrilled, and he deserved a hit. You know, he had been struggling for so many years, playing all these shows. It was one of the most unexpected, like, bizarre comebacks in rock history.
You know, there's something to be said about a good novelty song. Even a great artist can write, Yellow Submarine was a novelty song in its own way. Like, there's no fronting on the Dr. Demento canon, as it were, when our Hall of Famers stumble into it.
Right.
My Ding-a-Ling.
You disagree. You didn't think My Ding-a-Ling belonged on the list.
You know,
Chris,
I didn't. I would call myself somewhat of a fan of My Ding-a-Ling. And we've tolerated enough lighthearted and vulgar fare from other beloved characters in the history of the genre. And, you know, the original lyrics to Tutti Frutti were naughty and had a bit of a a grin to it in a similar way, you know? And you know what? And if AC/DC did My Ding-a-ling, they would be like, they'd be playing it on the Super Bowl.
I could see it as an AC/DC song.
I mean, AC/DC or Two Chainz.
I think the issue isn't like, I think usually just like most double entendres in rock and roll are delivered with a little more elan than Chuck Berry delivered My Ding-a-ling. You know, there's a little bit more of a wink, a little, it's a little,
it's,
you know.
It's like a single entendre almost. It's just barely even, right. Yeah, you know, I've seen him in concert a whole lot, and there's always a moment when this song starts, and I'm just like, oh,
he always plays it.
He always plays it, and I'm so deflated because I'm dying to hear something else, to hear anything else, basically. But the crowd goes nuts, and he feeds
off
the
energy. Really? They go nuts for My Ding-a-ling?
I didn't mean the stupid pun.
So just an eruption of applause.
An eruption of applause, not anything else.
Anyway, you were saying, Andy.
They go crazy. They are euphoric about the song, and Chuck on stage is always so happy to see the applause. He really cherishes the song, because for him, it was validation in a weird way, because he wasn't a guy that had a real big career. He was only famous for a few years. He gets tossed in prison. By the time that he gets out, he's washed up. He's passé. So for him, it was like a wonderful thing.
Right. Okay. I'm just going to try to avoid saying the title.
Yeah.
Again.
Okay. That's for the best.
Anyway. No,
I'm immature enough that I can say it a couple more times, you know?
Let's move on from My Ding-a-ling.
Rolling Stone is now hiring second graders to produce their editorial.
Andy, let's get into some of your personal picks for terrible songs by great artists.
All right. My first one is by The Who are my favorite band of all time. But 1981, they did a song called Did You Steal My Money?
Did you steal my money? Did you steal my money? Are you out there?
It was off of Face Dances, which is an album that I actually enjoy. But you can, like, smell the cocaine when you hear this song. It's you can see Pete Townsend all jittery and paranoid after a really epic night of doing blow. And he thinks he's been robbed. And the whole song is just this spastic repetition of, did you steal my money? And it's the most coked out thing I've heard in my entire life. And they recorded it. And it's sort of fun in a weird way, but it's sort of early 80s, dark, like, cokey. I think that scene in, like, Boogie Nights when the robbery at the house, it was that same time period. Just like dark and paranoid to almost violent extremes.
Well, it starts with like Pete repeating that refrain kind of in the background. And then, you're right. Some of the lyrics have this like kind of crazy, almost like Neil Young level of simplicity, but kind of crazy. Like, did you screw me? Did you do me? Did you use me? Why'd I trust you? Why'd you abuse me? I won't bust you.
Yes,
right.
And Daltrey does his best with it, but he's singing in sort of this weird tough guy voice that just really falls apart. And about a year later, they ended the band, which is for the best at that point, probably. They were kind of used up. They did a few more great songs. They still managed to make Eminence Front, which I love. But this was sort of the end of that period of the group. The drugs had consumed everything. Pete's brain was starting to rot.
This is like a topic for a lot of bands. Like they're feeling like they've been ripped off, or they're hating their label or their manager. But usually it's delivered with like maybe a little slight something a little bit veiled, a little
bit,
you know. They
don't outright say, did you steal my money?
Right. Like, I know John Fogerty, Zance Can't Dance, which is not one of his greatest, but he tried a little harder.
Little. He was still sued over it, but Zance himself. But
All right. Well, Andy, what's the next on your list?
Let's do Paul Simon's Cars Are Cars.
And
there's not a lot of horrible Paul Simon songs, because he's crazily talented.
Which is maybe why this one sticks out so much.
Cars are cars all over the world. Cars are cars all over the world, similarly made, similarly sold, in a motorcade, abandoned when rolled.
In 1983, I think he was engaging in some of the same behaviors as Pete Townsend by this point. He made Hearts and Bones, which was supposed to be his big reunion album that was with Garfunkel. And they even recorded a few songs together, but Paul felt it was too personal of an album, so he went back and he erased Art's parts, which Art is still pissed about to this day. But I can't imagine why Cars Are Cars was too personal to sing. It's like a children's song. He keeps saying cars are cars all over the world. He's saying that no matter where you go, the cars are the same. And then later we learn, but people are very different all over the world. Hmm. They aren't like cars. But the delivery of it.
And cars literally aren't the same.
I don't think they are.
Like, have you ever been to Berlin?
Have you been to Havana? Yeah. The awesome 50s different. Cars?
Yeah, he says an engine in the front, jack in the back, wheels take the brunt, pinion and a rack. Cars are cars all over the world.
Oh, the VW bug.
Now you have hybrid cars.
Well,
man.
Yeah, so Paul's wrong on the basic premise of his song.
This really is, I mean, this really, it does sound like kind of like a parody of a Paul Simon song.
It's shockingly bad. Yeah. I think his quality control at this point was very briefly off. It was during his weird marriage to Carrie Fisher. This is the same year that she made Return of the Jedi.
Right.
Then they got the voice. It's a whole mess.
It's uncanny because he's, you know, delivering the songs in that voice, and it sounds like they should be, you know.
But he's singing nonsense. Right. That's even like, even correct nonsense, which is why Graceland was so shocking 3 years later, because no one thought that the Cars Are Cars guy would be able to pull out of Graceland.
Maybe we could do a list about comebacks from terrible songs. Yeah. Greatest comebacks.
It's number one.
Why not here making work for me?
Your next choice, Andy, is kind of controversial. It's from one of Neil Young's, you know, biggest selling albums.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad Neil Young songs, but I decided I should grade on a curve somewhat and go to Harvest, which is his most beloved album. It's his best selling album. But he got the London Symphony Orchestra to play on a few songs, and it wasn't the best thing for him or the songs.
There's a world you're living in. No one else has your part.
The song There's a World, it's so overblown, it's so overdramatic, it's just awful. They took a small sketch of the song that's barely even like a good song to begin with and just layer in a billion horns and everything and strings, and it's just like, what the hell is this?
I think it absolutely, if you're grading on a curve in terms of like, you know, this is such a great album, you know, with songs like, you know, Old Man and
Out on the Weekend, Out on Harvest, the Weekend, Heart of Gold.
Kind of like terrible troughs on great albums.
Yeah, and then there's a world, bomb, bomb.
Right.
Bomb, bomb. It's just, what the hell?
All right, next one, Bruce Springsteen.
Well, this is off of Human Touch, which was his worst album. I think what happened, it was
Real Man.
It's called Real Man off Human Touch. What happened was, it was the 90s, but not everybody got that memo, so it was still thought of as like the 80s by some of his old timers, even though this was post Nevermind. And if you listen to this thing, the production screams 80s. It's so dated. The drums and the synths just bury everything. And he was almost like too happy in his life and his time to write great songs. He was just married, he had kids, and just Real Man is, it's like a parody of a Bruce song. There's not much
this
there.
Is another one that did kind of sound like a parody of a song.
Yeah, he really just sort of lost his way for a few years, and this is sort of the peak of it. He just talks about taking a girl out to the movies, and they see a real man on the screen, but he's the real man, and it just doesn't even kind of work.
Production-wise, it kind of has some of the worst elements, I think, of Born in the USA. I mean, it's kind of slightly overblown, or, you know.
Yeah, he never had a great producer for some of his times, and they just, he didn't realize that records shouldn't sound like this. You can get away with it in, like, 84, but by 92, it just was not going
to
fly.
I'm not usually the one to pick up the In Defense of Bruce Springsteen torch here.
Yeah.
But I will say, I do think maybe Bruce did get the memo, because 57 Channels
That's an outlier.
Was basically an Octung Baby.
Yeah, but it's such an extreme outlier on the album that it's just like fell out of the sky or something. Most of the rest of it's so different. You're right, that has no guitar on it, it's just bass.
Yeah, it's dope.
You switch round and round till half past dawn. There was 57 channels and nothing on. 57 channels and nothing.
If he did a whole record of just 57 channels, we would probably be talking about Human Touch the same way we talk about Octung Baby or Kiko and the Lavender Moon. Those kind of Mersch artists go alterna.
And he was so bold with it. He put it out as a single. He made a video, and he's basically rapping on it.
Yeah, no, it might be my favorite Bruce Springsteen song. Bruce Springsteen's 57 channels and U2's Numb. Yeah. Like, that was a really cool period for...
and it lasted like 7 months.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But which actually, I can use that to transition into the things I'm going to talk about.
Uh-huh. Well, before we're going to get to that. Before we do that, Andy has one more song, which is another artist who fell victim to quite a bit of 80s production. we think we've all heard of him, Bob Dylan.
Yes. It was hard to pick a worse Dylan song from the 80s because there's so many of them. This is from Knocked Out Loaded, which is his worst album. Which
people agree.
Even the title implies these are songs he knocked out while drunk, basically. it's mostly covers, and this appears to be a cover because it's the same title as a 1920s like gospel song, essentially, that was covered by Hank Williams. But he took that title, and he made a whole crap new song out of the song, and it's the worst 80s production I've ever heard on a single veteran artist of anybody. It's called Drifting Too Far From the Shore. I tried to eat you, honey, but you're drifting too far from the shore.
Drifting too far from shore. Yeah. It's kind of got every Dylan 80s cliche in one song. Like the terrible, the shouty vocals, you know, the awful synths.
And the drum with this echo effect on it. It's just, each drum beat is just like a dagger to your spleen or something. It's like, what the hell? The guy that 20 years previously was making Blonde on Blonde was just, it's almost unimaginable he can make a song this terrible, an album this bad.
Well, speaking of beats, maybe this is a good transition to a couple of Chris's personal picks, which both involve
some musicians' beats. Reactions to rap music at the time. You know, which reminded me a lot of the 90s, how people were reacting to Nirvana and U2 and the new alternative nation of Jane's Addiction and the Pixies and Faith No More and stuff. And it was sort of like that in the 80s with rap music, although definitely a little bit of growing pains in there. And certain artists were really, really smart about it. Yes was a great example of... of Owner of a Lonely Heart, the way it uses a sampler is... Right. Brilliant.
Okay, I thought I was trying to rack my brain for a Yes hip hop song.
Like Owner of a Lonely Heart was such an embrace of the technology that hip hop in turn embraced it back.
Right.
It was that smart and dead on. Herbie Hancock's Rocket. Total game changer.
Right.
Lou Reed's original rapper, not so much.
Yeah.
But I do think maybe a little unfairly maligned.
Yeah, and
it's not you know, it's got that kind of Art of Noise vibe to it.
And it had a definite wink in it, and he was making fun of himself as someone who always had these spoken sung lyrics. And so it made some sense as a novelty song, sort of, yeah. Check what's in the batter, make sure the cane is in the original rapper. Hey,
pitcher, better check that batter. Make sure the cane is in the original rapper. Hey, pitcher. Which brings us to Dee Dee Ramone, a.k.a. Dee Dee King.
Okay, well, there was a little, and I know there was a little bit of argument about whether Dee Dee belongs on this list, just because, you know, as a solo artist, he didn't make great albums, but he did write some of the greatest songs ever.
Some of the greatest punk rock songs
for the Ramones.
He was their best writer, probably.
Absolutely. So with that in mind, he belongs.
Yeah.
Yes. So his rap album is a little notorious, especially since the Funky Man video started making the YouTube rounds.
I was kind of surprised by your pick here because I would have picked Funky Man, but go ahead.
Well, I not only own the album on cassette, but I've heard the entire thing. And there's definitely worse songs on there. The worst of all being German Kid.
Guy with the rhyme about the pyramid. Bet you didn't know I was a German kid. Und ich finde es gut, wenn Leute lacht. Ich hab die Energie, ich hab die Kraft. Ein hübsches Mädchen gibt.
The German language is one of the least funky languages in all of the world's tongues. And he uses it to such a degree. He raps in English and he raps in German.
Well, you know, he
keeps pushing the fact that he's half German as like this amazing piece of trivia. Like he literally says it, I bet you didn't know I was half German. Like, anyone right. cares. Like, right. it's like, that is right. not remotely interesting, especially since you came from a band that had a weird Nazi fixation yeah. throughout their entire career.
He was keeping that Ramon simplicity. Interestingly, I mean, Dee Dee, he was very serious about hip hop, right? I mean, he really genuinely believed.
He quit the Ramones to do it.
He needed to be, he was very serious about this hip hop album.
And
about
a major label put this out.
A major label put it out. I didn't realize he was actually German. I know he spent some of his childhood
half
in
German.
Right. Yeah. Okay. He spent some of his childhood.
Did you
in
not
Germany.
Even listen to the song? he was half German.
I need to get the cassette. Obviously, but I mean, he spent some of his childhood in Germany because he was an army brat.
Yes.
Right. Obviously had a connection. This is part of
And he was empowered by Schoolie D. Much like the Beastie Boys were, actually. They really loved Schoolie.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the song Gucci Time meant a lot to Dee Dee because the idea of, you know, I had nothing and now I have a Gucci watch. He felt that was very, very empowering. But
unfortunately, Schoolie D is not here to defend himself from this association, but granted, Schoolie D is awesome. Yeah,
Schoolie D is incredible. Dee Dee King, the rapper, not so much.
What needs to be said is he left the best punk group of all time to put out the worst rap album of all time.
it really is a case, and it might be the worst rap record of 1989. Like, there really is not.
And there are a lot of terrible rap records from that era, sure. A lot of people. Let's back up. This does lead us to maybe the big kahuna of terrible
so to
rap
speak.
Records. Yeah.
The big Kokomo here are. Our friend Brian Wilson. Well, Brian Wilson, to his credit, never technically released Smart Girls. It was on the album Sweet Insanity, which was supposed to be released in 1991, the very, very end of his tenure with his completely scrupulous and helpful friend Eugene Landy. It was the very, very last song on a record that was never released. So, to Brian's credit, it never technically saw the light of day, but thank you, the internet. it does exist. Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys did a rap song called Smart Girls.
My name is Brian and I'm the man. I write hit songs with the wave of my hand. Songs to surf and sun and sand. I make great music with my band. Songs to dance to and
was it a response to Run DMC's Dumb Girl? You don't know.
I don't know. It would have been a really late response. It would have been a remarkably late response.
Which is appropriate for that time of his life.
Yes, it's true. But, you know, it's like, you know, Run DMC was not a fan of Dumb Girls, and Brian Wilson is not a fan of Dumb Girls. So, you know, they had some affinity there. I think the original Wipeout rap cover was supposed to be with Run DMC, who smartly declined.
But the Fat Boys happily took it off.
Well, the Fat Boys didn't turn down a fucking thing in the late 80s. Like, those dudes would do anything, for better and worse, to be fair. But Brian, I think, does sing on the Fat Boys Wipeout, and I have no idea if there's any connection between that and this song that came 4 years later.
Maybe we should just
keep... My name is Brian, and I'm the man. I write hit songs with the wave of my hand.
Smart girls, I love the smart girls. You brainy babes with your attitudes. Big brains are awesome, dude. Smart, 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 smart. girls.
And he name checks like 10 different Beach Boys songs here.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean,
well, they're sampled throughout. And the beat the beat itself is kind of cool. It's kind of that post Tall Cool One, Robert Plant, where it's like you're injecting the old hits in there. Yeah. It kind of sounds like, not to age myself too much, but it kind of sounds like the Double D and Steinsky mashup stuff that was going around a little bit earlier.
But I would agree that the Beach Boys samples are kind of what really pushes this up to the totally over the top. It's just kind of crazy because they're just totally dropped in. I mean, like kind of in an insane way, dissonant way.
Really, really disgustingly thrown in there, which I would actually kind of be into if, you know, from that like Asphodel Records, invisible scratch pickle nuttiness of Christian Marclay pastiche art, I would be a total defender of this Beach Boys B-Boy revision had he not had lines like this. I'm no different from the rest. I love hips and legs and breasts. But strictly on a higher plane, what really turns me on is her brain.
Yeah. Well, and what must be said was he was under complete control of a psychotic therapist that named this album Sweet Insanity against Brian's wishes, because that offended him, and probably forced him to record this against his will. I mean, he was really not in control of himself.
So Brian, he does win the ultimate prize from possibly one of the worst songs by a great artist, but with a couple asterisks that he was under the control of a guru-like person, and this was never released.
It was never technically released. Okay. But
we're still going to give it to him.
It happens. Let me also say, this entire list is a little difficult for me because I'm actually always a big fan of the songs people skip. I love Revolution Number 9. I love the Pearl Jam Bug song on Vitalogy.
I think
that's
Boris the Spider. You'd be a fan of that.
Like the Kurt Cobain Beans song that sounds like Young Marble Giants on Helium or whatever. Like, I love all those songs. And I think that those are the type of songs that open people's minds to other sounds and the avant-garde and things they would have not have been introduced to on an album otherwise. And I think those things are great, but those things are fewer and far between than the colossal flops that we are talking about today.
And just broadly speaking, a great deal of these songs were brought to you by cocaine. I mean, that's
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point, too. I mean, like, you know, in terms of bad influences, I think cocaine is probably the worst influence of all the drugs, on music.
Strangely,
there's more bad cocaine albums made
strangely,
than any other drug.
Bowie thrived on it. The more coke he did, the better he got. It was really bizarre.
Well, he forgot like whole years of the 70s, but he
But he made great music under a state of cocaine psychosis. But he's the exception.
We don't have the results of the Jenkum era's musical output. So let's hold that.
We might have to save this for another episode. Chris Weingarten, Andy Green, thank you for coming on.
Of course.
And the full list, the definitive list of terrible songs by great artists is on rollingstone.com. Thanks, guys.
.com.
And that's it for Rolling Stone Music Now. If you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks.
Welcome to Talkville,
the ultimate Smallville rewatch podcast. Guest star Sarah Carter as Alicia Baker.
Although I didn't really work with her a lot. But Tom did, and they had some real big smoochy scenes.
Yeah. Should we talk about that?
Could there be any more sex? What was a 3-page makeout scene that just kept going? Good Lord. We get it. They have chemistry.
Jump in now or catch up on any of the past seasons of Talkville on YouTube or wherever you listen.